And welcome back to Coast tonight. Investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us, followed in our last hour with conversations with Linda. You know, oysters in the northwestern part of the United States are dying at an alarming rate. Why? That's one of the stories Linda will tackle for us when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Linda Moulton Howe with us. We've got lots to cover with Linda, so we'll get right into it. Linda, first of all, welcome back. And my gosh, there's so much going on.
Oh, I know. Every 24 cycle, it's like 100 times what it was last year. And on April 22nd, 2016, something happened that's never been seen before. It was Earth Day, and never have so many countries signed an agreement at once as 175 did on opening day to sign the Paris Agreement to fight what is now seemingly a relentless rise in global air and ocean temperatures. Even North Korea signed. The nations that did not sign the agreement on April 22nd have a year to do so. China, it's the world's top carbon dioxide emitter, announced its intentions to, quote, finalize domestic procedures, close quote, to ratify the Paris Agreement before the gathering of the G20 summit in China 5 months from now in September. The second largest CO2 emitter, the United States, represented by Secretary of State John Kerry, pledged to ratify the Paris Agreement this year. And so did the 28-nation European Union, along with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and leaders of Mexico and Australia. As CO2 continues to increase from a variety of sources, temperature data around the world through 2015 showed that the average global temperature on Earth has climbed at least 1.02 degrees Celsius, which is halfway to the dangerous threshold of a 2 degrees Celsius increase that, if reached this century, scientists say could mean ice melting faster in Arctic, Greenland, and Antarctica, and that would mean faster rising sea levels and threats to many life forms from the oceans to islands to land. And warming ocean waters are killing corals. The UK's Guardian headlined on April 16th, I was shocked. Most of the coral in the Great Barrier Reef is dead or dying. That was writer James Woodford, who does science reporting from the field for The Guardian. He described his firsthand trip along the Great Barrier Reef, and he wrote, quote, what I was seeing beneath me was evidence of an environmental disaster that has been unfolding over the past few months. The largest mass coral bleaching event ever recorded in this region, close quote. In April, the UK's National Coral Bleaching Task Force reported that 95% of the Great Barrier Reef is now severely bleached and should be placed on the endangered species list. Without the massive coral reefs, an untold number of other marine life will have to move somewhere else or they will perish. Not only is CO2 in the atmosphere causing a global warming problem, but the gas has been absorbed by the Earth's oceans in great quantities the past few decades. And without that enormous absorption, the Earth would be even warmer. But all that CO2 absorption in the waters is changing ocean chemistry that can kill marine creatures such as oysters. On April 4th, 2016, Oregon State University News headlined that, quote, the ocean chemistry along the west coast of North America is changing rapidly because of global carbon dioxide emissions, and the oyster industry is confronted with high mortality rates of juvenile oysters because of increasingly acidified water. One man who has devoted his life and career to understanding and protecting marine organisms is Stephen Palumbi, PhD and professor of biology, director of the Hopkins Marine Station at Stanford University in Monterey, California. Recently, in an Earth Files interview, he explained why oysters and the Great Barrier Reef are having such a hard time Staying Alive. Here now from Stanford University is Professor Stephen Palumbi.
The little tiny larvae that make the oyster farms run and be profitable and productive have to make little tiny shells, and if the water is too acidified, then those tiny oyster larvae can't make their shells. They die. Farms then can't do the aquaculture that a lot of oyster lovers all over the country depend on.
From your point of view right now, as we speak in April 2016, how serious is this threat to the oyster supply on the Pacific coast?
That threat is pretty severe. There are these two reasons why the ocean is becoming more acidified. One is the global presence of CO2 in the atmosphere. But there are local CO2s in coastal areas because microbes are out of balance in coastal water because of nutrification or pollution or other, like sedimentation and runoff. Over the last couple of years, we've discovered that too much CO2 in the water is this huge invisible coastal water pollutant that we didn't know existed. And that coastal water pollutant is what the oyster farms are actually encountering. They had no idea what was killing the larvae or what was destroying their business, but there's this global problem as well.
Is it possible that within the next 25 years that the seafood world would be dead or dying or incapable of meeting demands of voracious humans who like seafood? The decline could finally convince China and some of the other countries that they are not going to be able to live as normal unless they stop what they're doing with coal and other CO2 and methane producing industries.
I think the seafood decline will play a role, but one of the additional problems then is that as wild seafood declines in abundance for the reasons that you said, that people turn more and more to aquaculture. Aquaculture can be done really well, but it can also be done in a very damaging way. And the more that countries use damaging aquaculture to grow food, then the further back we're pushed.
That leads to The Guardian on April 16th, quote, "I was shocked. Most of the coral in the Great Barrier Reef is dead or dying." And this is an article by James Woodford, who is a science reporter for The Guardian. It seems like it is part of this great issue of what is happening to the oceans chemically that is causing death and so many problems worldwide.
I think you're exactly right that there's a huge link here. The link is because of what CO2 actually does in the ocean and in the atmosphere. So acidification is what happens when CO2 goes into the ocean. Like we were just talking about, oysters are a big problem. For corals, this event is the biggest, most dramatic bleaching event that's ever been seen on the Great Barrier Reef, particularly the northern Great Barrier Reef. Reefs all over the world provide a lot of seafood because fish live on coral reefs, but they are also living seawalls. They capture a lot of the wave energy that hits them and protects the shoreline behind them. So imagine if you were living along the east coast of the United States or on the Atlantic coast of Europe, and all of a sudden 95% of the seawalls on that entire coast crumbled into dust. That is what just happened on the Great Barrier Reef. The reason why they make reefs is because they secrete skeletons. The skeletons are made of calcium carbonate. They're one of the kinds of organisms which, as the CO2 level goes up, they have a harder and harder time in making those skeletons. Right now, most of the CO2 levels that corals are facing are not as debilitating as what the oysters are facing. But the corals in the Great Barrier Reef are actually experiencing the other CO2 problem, and that's ocean warming. So CO2 in the atmosphere creates a blanket that holds in heat, and as a consequence, ocean temperatures have been going up all over the world. We think of corals as being tropical, and they are, and they must love hot water, and they do, but they're kind of wimpy in that if the water goes a degree or two above what their physiology would normally limit them to, they undergo this phenomenon of bleaching. They spit out their internal symbionts that are colored. They turn white, and they no longer have a food supply, and so 50 to 80% of them die. what that says is that even when you are managing things as well as possible, you're still subject to these problems of ocean warming. The Great Barrier Reef is under these sort of stresses. Think about all of the reefs in the Caribbean that are less well managed, all the reefs around the Pacific that are less well managed. They're likely to be equally or worse off. So the service that that reef provides just in capturing waves and protecting communities against storm damage is an incalculable kind of value that is being lost. In the United States, Hurricane Sandy hit New York and woke everybody up to the idea that wave surges and storms when the sea level is going up actually is a big problem. So sea levels are going up, storms are increasing, and at the same time, the ability of living marine creatures to make living seawalls, to make barriers that protect communities against storm surge, is also declining.
What do you think would be the best way to sequester CO2 from getting into the ocean waters?
Right now, the only way that I can imagine sequestering CO2 is actually by not putting it in the atmosphere at all. That switching to renewable sources of energy, solar power, wind power, hydropower, are the ways of reducing that CO2 emission. But we're not talking about magic here. We are talking about technology that allows us to capture energy for free from the sun and from tides and from water and from wind, putting those into grids that allow people to live normal, high-energy lives, but without this creeping, corrosive addition of CO2 into our planet's lungs and our planet's bloodstream.
What do you say to people who argue, well, there was a time of dinosaurs on the planet when there was no ice at the Antarctic or the Arctic, and they lasted for 80-some million years, so what is the big deal now?
Well, dinosaurs didn't own condos in Miami, and you know, if it was just dinosaurs, it wouldn't be a problem, but it's not about dinosaurs, and it's not even about, you know, the life of the oceans. It's about people. And a good fraction of our species lives on coastlines in very complicated cities that will not be able to function if sea level goes up too much and storms wash the ocean into those cities. It's not just Bangladesh, it's not just places that are developing countries, but we have communities around the United States that are seriously affected now by rising tides and are going to be inundated. There was an amazing paper that came out about a month or so ago about king tide. King tide is when strong tides lead to coastal flooding of communities, roads, people's houses, bridges, everything. Surveyors asked people, 30 years ago, did you ever hear of king tides? Was there ever any flooding? People say, oh, every once in a while something would happen, but no, it wasn't very common, and now it happens all the time.
Right.
So this change in what we call king tides is a real harbinger of the kinds of changes that will be affecting us. And it's not that we're worried about the coastal ecosystems in king tides. It's our own infrastructure that we have to worry about in our society. So when people say, well, the planet will deal with it, I totally agree. The planet will deal with it. In a million years, the planet won't even know that we did this to it. But we're really worried about the next 100 years and maybe the next 200 years where our kids and grandchildren and our legacy really is under threat. That's what it's about. It's about people.
What do you think, realistically, is the worst case on the current timeline of 2016 going forward? When might we be in such a turbulent world that everything you just stated will be putting every human and every creature on the planet under stress simply to survive?
I think that that's absolutely true. It increases the stress on all marine life because the water's too warm. For people, there's less food. There's more need to repair coastal infrastructure, cities and roads and ports. All of that is more and more and more energy fighting this process that we've got. But we still are in a period of time where we can make a choice. If we look at business as usual scenarios where we're just going to pump CO2 into the atmosphere at the rate we're doing right now, then in 85 years, by the year 2100, all the predictions are that catastrophic changes will happen around the planet and the ocean that really change how we actually can use the ocean, whether it's for seafood or for coastal protection or whatever. Acidification by that point will be so global that the sort of problems that Oregon oystermen were seeing just locally will be global, worldwide, over all the oceans if business as usual keeps going. But things are beginning to change. And we know that if we begin to slow down putting in CO2 in the atmosphere, and we essentially stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere, say in the next 35 years, by 2050, if we were to do that, then the world would begin to shake off the CO2 addiction, the CO2 would become scrubbed out of the atmosphere, and then by 2100, things will begin to be getting better. So the kind of disastrous circumstances that you were describing are absolutely on track right now, but we still can choose. We're still in a decade of choice.
And George, if you go to my earthfiles.com report about the whole global warming impact and absorption of CO2 in the oceans and the air, there is an extraordinary graph from the Hadley Center, the UK Met Office, that shows from 1850 to 2015 and climbing how persistent and just never letting up, really, this global pattern of warming has been. And it was in Science, April 8th, the journal Science, this amazing headline: global warming is changing the way the Earth spins on its axis. And this is from a very interesting paper that talks about how global warming is shifting the way our Earth wobbles on its polar axis. And this is from data from NASA. And it comes back to melting ice sheets, especially those in the Northern Hemisphere in Greenland. They're changing the distribution of weight on the Earth. Greenland is melting much, much faster than anybody had expected by now. And that has caused both the North Pole and this wobble, which is called polar motion, to change sort of their course. And that is from the melting ice. And some of the scientists said this recent shift from the 20th century direction is really dramatic and highlights how real and profoundly large this global warming, whether from humans, we're coming out of an ice age, all the combinations, it's having a big effect on the planet. Since 2003, Greenland alone has lost on average more than 600 trillion pounds of ice a year. That's why where this wobble is changing. And one of the scientists who was a co-author on this study that was published in Science, Eric Ivan, said that he likes to think, quote, of it as a billion trucks each year dumping ice out of Greenland. And on top of that, West Antarctica loses 275 trillion pounds of ice, and East Antarctica gains about 165 trillion pounds of ice yearly. And that is affecting the wobble, and the reason for those changes in loss and gain in West Antarctica and East Antarctica has to do with the changing wind patterns. The wind patterns have changed because of global warming, and so there can be ice deposit in one area and tremendous loss in another, all consistent with what is happening in global warming.
That's a great story, Linda. We're going to come back and talk about reincarnation and past lives. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Linda Moulton Howe, and we're going to talk about past lives in this segment. This has got to be fascinating for even you, Linda, right?
Oh, it really, truly is. I think it's one of the most important subjects that all of us should try to study. And It was back in November of 1984 that I was a speaker at the University of Nebraska with astronomer and Center for UFO Studies founder J. Allen Hynek, PhD. And at that conference, I presented my investigations of bloodless, trackless animal mutilations around the world. And Dr. Hynek talked about his 1960s investigations of UFOs and his work as a scientific advisor for the U.S. Air Force and Project Blue Book. And Allen would later criticize that Project Blue Book as deliberately deceiving the public and media about an alien presence. He eventually concluded that the public Project Blue Book was a government PR effort to deflect attention from unidentified aerial phenomena that authorities secretly behind the scenes referred to as advanced extraterrestrial biological entities, and sometimes other dimensionals, and other times time travelers. We talked about all of that. And after our respective talks to the conference, Dr. Hynek said to me, "Linda, let's let our hair down with each other." And I thought, wow, I'm going to learn what Hynek really knows about UFOs and ETs.
Plus, he was almost bald. He didn't have any hair.
Well, that's true. We went to a quiet room away from the conference buzz. And to my surprise, Dr. Hynek began with, "Linda, the most important book I've ever read, and hope you will read too for more understanding about the complexities of this phenomena, is a book, Theosophy, by Rudolf Steiner."
Huh.
Now, neither Hynek nor I knew that he would pass into another dimension only a year and a half later from a brain tumor.
Yes.
And I would not learn from abductees about alleged ET soul transfer technology, or as some call it, resurrection technology, for seven more years in 1991. And that was when abductee Linda Porter sent me illustrations after she had seen human soul life force radiating as a gold-orange light moving from a dying man's body into a younger cloned version of that man. And that clone was preserved in a lighted tube under the supervision of a praying mantis and gray Eben-type ETs. And all of the Linda Porter case with her color illustrations, which are so fine, are in my third book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness. It's always in my Earthfile shop. Well, from that to Rudolf Steiner's book, it is about reincarnation as the machinery of the universe. And he called flaming souls that are the vital link between matter that dies and the spirit dimension that is eternal and gains knowledge through eternity by moving in and out of all kinds of body containers in the matter world. Perhaps human souls have the potential to be stronger and freer than whatever life force is in the aliens that depend upon cloning and hybridization to survive. I wish he were here to have that discussion. And yet reincarnation is as controversial as UFOs in terms of being real or not. In the past few months, there have been various scientific articles about using DNA to store massive quantities of digital data. That idea provoked for me the question, could DNA memory storage explain children who vividly in great detail remember previous lives? I took that question to Jim Tucker, MD, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia, and here he is now from Charlottesville.
Most of the cases involve a child who reports memories of a past life of somebody who they are not related to. For memories to be passed down through the genes, the child would have to be a direct descendant of the previous person. And also, 3/4 of our kids talk about how they died in the previous life, and obviously genes get passed on before someone is at their death scene. So there's no way those memories could be transferred through their genes. One well-known example here in the U.S., and we've studied 2,500 cases from around the world, but one of the well-known ones in the U.S. is a little boy named James Leininger, who had memories of being a World War II pilot. It's believed that pilot has now been identified. James is born from this Christian couple in Louisiana. His dad in particular is quite opposed to the idea of past lives. But around the time of James's second birthday, he started having horrific nightmares multiple times a week, where he'd be kicking his legs up in the air, screaming, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out." And also during the day, he would repeatedly take his toy airplanes and say, "Airplane crash on fire," and slam it into the family's coffee table. So sometime after his second birthday, his parents were also able to talk with him while he was awake about these memories. And he said how he had been a pilot and that his plane had crashed on fire, that he had been shot down by the Japanese. And he said that he flew a Corsair, now this is a two-year-old, flew a Corsair, which is a type of plane that I'd never heard of, but one that was developed during World War II. And then he said he flew off of a boat, and his parents asked him the name of the boat, and he said Natoma. And his dad then found there had been USS Natoma Bay that was stationed in the Pacific during World War II. He printed out the information, which the printout shows the date he printed it out. So documents when James was 28 months old, the word Natoma was part of the story. They also asked him who he had been, and he would always say, "Me or James." They also asked him one time who else was there, and he said, "Jack Larson." He later said that he had been shot down at Iwo Jima, and it turned out that the USS Natoma Bay did, in fact, take part in the Iwo Jima operation. There was only one pilot from the ship that was killed during that operation, which was a 21-year-old young man from Pennsylvania named James Houston. So if James Leininger was remembering a past life, it had to be Houston's life because he was the only pilot on the Natoma Bay who was killed at Iwo Jima. Well, it turns out that Houston, in fact, had flown a Corsair. His plane crashed exactly as James described. He said how his plane was hit in the engine, it burst into flames, crashed in the water and quickly sank, which is exactly what Houston's plane did. And James had said how Jack Larson was there with him, and Jack Larson was the pilot of the plane next to Houston on the day that he was killed.
Hmm.
So this is a case where the father did the research on this, but we've got very good documentation that was made before he was able to identify Houston as a pilot. And details from little James matched perfectly with this World War II pilot who had been killed 60 years before he was born. Houston and his family had absolutely no connection to James's family, and it seems impossible that he could have learned that information through any sort of normal means.
Does that mean that there is a soul spirit memory that absorbs lifetimes and can recycle in a reincarnative cycle, and that humans would remember past lives?
Well, we really can only speculate about exactly what this means. In the narrowest terms, it provides good evidence that some children have memories of a life from the past. So the most obvious explanation is that they're remembering a past life because they experienced that past life, which would imply some kind of continuation. We would certainly be tempted to say a spirit or a soul. I suspect it's probably more complex than we can really understand, but it would be something like that. But there are other explanations possible. One idea that some people have proposed is that the child is connecting with this data bank of memories, but not that the child actually experienced those things himself, even though the child thinks that he did because he has these quote-unquote memories, but that he didn't really have that life. There are other speculative ways of looking at these cases, that they don't really prove what the process is, but I do think they provide strong evidence that there can be this connection between lives of an individual continuing from one life to another.
What about the possibility that DNA itself is some kind of a medium in which entire life experiences can be encoded in ways that maybe we haven't understood and so far don't have a way to extract, but the DNA itself can record?
Well, it's certainly an interesting thing to speculate, but our cases would not be consistent with that explanation because the children are not descendants of the previous person or even descendants of anyone who was present when these things were happening. As far as whether genes can carry memories, if it does, for the most part, it had to be on some sort of unconscious kind of level because, as far as we know, most children don't come out reporting memories of their grandparents or their great-grandparents.
Well, let's go back to the idea of the body container in which there is an animating spirit soul. It seems that the work you are doing with children, it links to the out-of-body experiences of people who have been near death. There's a part of them that seems to leave the body container and have extraordinary experiences in some other dimension, and then they come back to describe. So again, it seems this is all reinforcing the concept that there is some sort of a soul spirit that is going in and out of body containers, has some sort of a matrix of its own that can record life experiences and retell them.
Well, that's right. We use slightly different terminology, but yes, there's this idea that consciousness can exist separate from a functioning brain. So in our cases of the children, it appears that this consciousness has continued after someone died, and it somehow becomes associated with a new developing brain and shows up as past life memories. In the case of near-death experiences, yes, people can describe incredible experiences that happens in another realm like heaven. Some of them have also given details of things that happened around them as they were physically at the point of death, as their heart had stopped and the code was underway to try to bring them back. And occasionally they will describe events that happened down the hall or even in another location that proves to be accurate for what was going on. So yes, it does suggest that there was this consciousness that was capable of experiencing new knowledge, of taking in new information while the brain was not functioning.
Is there any reason why we as a human family should not then embrace the concept of a soul spirit as a third part of mind, body, and spirit?
Well, soul and spirit have connotations that are not necessarily supported by this work. The work that we do is not from a religious perspective, but the work does suggest that, as you say, that there's this consciousness piece that can be considered separate from the body and the functioning brain. Beyond that, I think in the bigger picture, I would argue that the physical world, that it actually grows out of consciousness. That as Max Planck, who was the founder of quantum theory, as he said, he viewed consciousness as fundamental. He thought matter was derived from it. I think there's a lot of truth in that, and would mean that we would have no reason to think that consciousness would end when a physical brain dies, but the whole physical world grows out of consciousness, and these pieces of consciousness get attached to the brain but are not necessarily dependent on it.
Well, is there any reason why the soul-spirit concept shouldn't be part of the physics of body, mind, soul, spirit? What is wrong with that?
Well, the main objection, I would say the main mainstream objection, is that everything grows out of the physical. So there is this physical world, and animals develop through evolution, and the brain developing consciousness is just sort of a byproduct that happened to occur through certain evolutionary advantages. I think if we're going to use terms like soul and spirit, then we better define them rather carefully. For me, it's enough to just consider there is this consciousness or mind, or if you prefer, spirit piece, that is a separate entity from the physical world. And I would say there is good evidence that it can exist after the physical body that it's attached to dies.
Do you suppose the implication is that there is a certain amount of time that a given soul spirit is supposed to be in a given body container. And if that is cut short for reasons, as you said, murder or something else that's not a natural death, that the time inside of a container is important some way, and that could explain why there are some recyclings?
Well, some people have talked about the idea of unfinished business, but it does seem either dying violently or actually dying young. There may well be something to this idea that a life that is cut short that leads the consciousness to continue on in a life here as if the last one didn't fulfill its complete purpose.
It gives hope beyond a planet that seems sometimes to be sinking into nothing but violence.
Exactly.
That's a great report, Linda.
Well, thank you. And coming back full circle to the book that J. Allen Hynek recommended to me, Theosophy by Rudolf Steiner, there is a section of that book entitled The Spirit in Spirit Land After Death. And these words I'm going to share now were written by Rudolf Steiner in 1922. Quote, "In each life, the human spirit appears as a repetition of itself with the fruits of its former experiences in previous lives. No two human beings have the same spiritual form. When the human spirit has passed through the world of souls on its way between two incarnations, it enters the land of spirits to remain there until it is ripe for a new bodily existence. Only by being embodied, incarnated, can man work in the world of bodies. He must take on the physical body as his tool so that through the body he can act on other bodies and they on him. What acts through this physical corporeality of man is the spirit. From this spirit flow the purposes, the direction its work is to take in the physical world. After its birth in the physical body, the soul, when met by some hard fate, has no glimmering of the fact that in the purely spiritual life before birth, the impulse that led to this hard fate had been voluntarily accepted by that soul. What therefore seems completely unwished for from the point of view of the earth life is willed by the soul itself in the supersensible," close quote. And in this conversation that Dr. J. Allen Hynek and I had back in 1984, what I had not experienced at that point were the people in the abduction syndrome who would come to me in 1991, half a dozen of them, and that they would had had experiences with something in the alien presence in which there were these resurrection technologies. And the bottom line that I was left with from them, because that is what was communicated, is that the universe, the cosmos, whatever big word you want to use, is multidimensional, and the key to everything is the recycling of the soul in and out of containers. Even if we don't have minds and consciousness large enough to understand it, that is the key.
That is the key indeed. And Linda, more great stories just ahead on Coast to Coast AM, including an Egyptian Sphinx-looking object.